For the train system, over.
K2YO. Bernie recognized, and I'm going to get to you in a second. Mel, was each individual machine shop taking AC voltage from Con Ed and converting it to DC to run their shop?
Tonight at 8 o'clock.
Were they converting it locally DC to run their shop? Or was were there
complete?
Or were there real DC mains? Now, if you had real DC mains in the street, that's a real problem, because how do you control the voltage drop of the guy that's further down the block? So, was the AC being converted to DC in each shop? Or I had the impression that certain stores and shops had DC coming directly from Con Ed. Over to you, Mel.
No doubt in the early days, of course, because when Edison did that famous wiring of a street in New York City to prove, the first time with the incandescent light bulbs, and he was a DC man. Listen, you know what went on between him and Hertz and Tesla and all those. They were trying to, of course, show the improvement that they would have with AC, and he did everything in his power to discredit AC. So for a good many years, the early years, I guarantee you everything was being run off the New York City on DC, Dick, over.
Yeah, but Edison did slowly, and he was fighting, by the way, Tesla, Westinghouse, anybody else who was involved in AC. I think it was Tesla who first really came up with the concept of three-phase AC. And Westinghouse jumped on that bandwagon, and so did Niagara Falls Power Station. But obviously Edison eventually caught on, because one of the things that's not well publicized is Edison accepted a contract to set up a shoe factory in Massachusetts to power the machines. And he set it up as three-phase AC. It was so successful, he eventually wired the whole darn town in Massachusetts on three-phase AC. So he eventually saw the light kind of quietly. But many people talk about that, because there was a significant period of time in which those experiments were going on in Manhattan. He thought AC was dangerous. It would create electrocution where DC would not. He thought it was only good to run an electrocution machine. And it took him quite a while to catch on to that one. Bernie, K2YO, go right ahead. K2RIW on the TechNet.
Good evening, Dick. Am I holding the repeater up okay?
Yes, a little bit noisy, but okay. Make sure you leave a couple of seconds of delay, Bernie. Go ahead.
Okay, I'm reading from a New York Times article dated November 14, 2007. They were reporting at that time Con Ed was cutting off the last DC voltage customer on 10 East 40th Street near the Midtown Manhattan Library. Apparently, as of 2007, they were still providing DC voltage. Interesting, the last comment, the man that was cutting off the link on 10 East 40th Street was Fred Simmons, who was a 52-year veteran of the company. Why him? Con Edison said he's our closest link to Con Edison.
Wow. So right up into 2007. Amazing. And how in the world did Con Ed do that? Because if I want to run a mile of wiring, and if I want to hook up 1,000 stores along that mile, let's see, that would be one store every 5 feet. That would be crazy. If I want to hook up 100 stores along that mile, every store 50-some-odd feet apart, obviously, the guy at the end of the line is going to get a hell of a lot lower voltage than the beginning of the line. I'd love to know how Con Ed did that. They must have had AC dropping transformers that rectified it into probably pulsating DC. And wait a minute now. I'm even having trouble believing that it would be pulsating DC, because many people were running AC-DC radios, and pulsating DC would have given a very unpleasant sound out of the radio. So by some means, a rotary machine with commutation was really giving them pure DC to each of those customers. What do you think, Bernie? Go ahead. Make sure you give it enough delay. K2LIW.
Do DC rectifiers.
Dynamos, Dick.
Yeah, I began to think it was rotary machines with the...
switching over, running. This is how the customers are dealing with it, that they're just putting DC converters. But it does not say anything about how they were getting there. It's a New York Times piece, so it's not that technical.
Yeah, Eric just guessed that it was a dynamotor. A dynamotor with a real contactor, with a real commutator, can give you quasi-pure DC, not counting the arcing of the commutator. Just plain rectifying of the AC wouldn't do it. That's going to give you a lot of pulsation. It would take rectification and filtering. And that takes a lot of microfarads to do it at power levels for 120 volts, to run a whole house, to run air conditioning and stuff like that. Boy, it would take farads to make it pure DC. So dynamotors, does that mean there was a kind of a dynamotor located at each pole pig transformer? What do you think, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW?
K2RIW, KE2EJ. Well, downtown was where most of the DC stuff was left in the 80s and 90s, but because of all the heavy machinery that used DC motors, the subway actually uses 600 volts DC. Most of that stuff is rectified. It's not pure, but if you go to the west side, there's a power station by the train yard there. Actually, by 58th Street, 59th Street. That's where they have a hole. If you ever look inside, you'll see that there's these huge dynamotors that they used for the subway. But most of the subway facilities are rectifiers. And what they did downtown was at various different locations, like on Pine Street. When we used to go visit George, K1 and TKJ, if you remember, WA2SUR, the theater was at 70 Pine Street, up there with a whole bank of dynamotors just to run the elevators. K2RW, K2J.
Yeah, dynamotors are one way to do it. Another way to do it is three-phase, full-wave rectification. I think that gives you, gives you 360 cycles per second. Yep. Full wave, three-phase rectification is the beginning of the process. And then if you have two separate rectifying transformers, one Y and one delta wired, because of the way Y and delta primary and secondary works, you get an intermediate phase. So you get 720 cycles per second instead of 360. Full-wave rectification with Y and delta can give you an amount of ripple that I think is like 1%, 1.5%, without any filtering. So I'll bet you they use combinations like that. In case of running a subway, I am positive there are no dynamotors running that subway. I'll bet you it is Y, delta, full-wave, three-phase rectification. And next time we get a hold of Andy, we can ask him about that. I think Andy has described some of that to me. KE2EJ or anyone else? K2RIW?
Yeah, well, I'm pretty sure you're right, except that one old power station on the west side is full of dynamos. Whether they use them or not anymore, I couldn't tell you.
What's your guess as to how often they got to replace the brushes on that commutator for that dynamotor to keep the DC pure? And you can imagine what happens to those brushes every time somebody creates a short circuit. Over to you, Eric.
You know, I wouldn't even begin to guess, but those are huge machines.
Yeah, hopefully they've got multiple sets of brushes, backup systems, all running in parallel. So you can probably replace a set of brushes without even turning the machine off because of all the parallelism on all the sets of brushes that are on that commutator. That's my guess. But the smart electronic way, in fact, you'd be amazed how many traveling wave tube power supplies must run on three-phase power. In order to run well, the three-phase power must be three equal amplitude phases of exactly 120 degrees apart each. And within the power supply itself, there are two separate transformers, a Y winding and a delta winding, and full-wave rectification on each. And that gives them a very pure amount of DC that requires very little filtering. That, in turn, goes to a inverter that inverts the high voltage to a much higher voltage, and the inverter itself is a kind of a switching power supply running at something like 100 KC, and it changes its pulse width modulation in order to further filter the voltage. The reason for all of that heroics in the power supply for a traveling wave tube is because it is extremely voltage sensitive. Your particular traveling wave tube may be running at a cathode voltage of 10,000 volts, but you want the 10,000 volts to be accurate to the nearest 1 volt. Because as you change the 10,000 volts 1 volt higher or lower, the beam going down the center of the tube goes faster or slower. That in turn creates phase modulation of the signal coming out of the tube. It's called ceridine modulation. And there's an intentional circuit used on electronic countermeasures machines, which uses the ceridine modulation characteristic of a traveling wave tube in order to not only create phase modulation, but to create frequency modulation. You have a properly designed ceridine modulated traveling wave tube. You can put in a signal of 10 gigahertz and get out something that is continuously 50 kilohertz higher in frequency than what you put in by using the right kind of sawtooth modulation in the ceridine manner of the voltage you're applying to the cathode of the tube. You're modulating the velocity of the beam going down the tube, and it changes frequency if you do it just right. Crazy system. So they do use this Y delta modulation in order to get very pure DC, requiring very little filtering. And I'm guessing that Con Ed probably was forced into doing that, because there was a hell of a lot of places where you don't want to put dynamotors. That example I gave of a number of blocks that are a mile long, and you're applying DC voltage. The poor guy at the end of the block is going to be getting a hell of a lot less voltage than the guy at the beginning of the block if there isn't local regulation and distribution. Anybody with any further questions or comments, give me your call letters. K2LIW, listening, TechNet.
2KEY, I think I got the answer.
All right. Now recognized. Anyone else?
Well, I have a question on the last subject we were talking about, but I'll wait a couple minutes.
Very good. You're right after Mel. Go ahead, Mel. And wait.
I got a book here. 1912. Edison Electric Institute was, he had an institute, all right, published 1912. And it tells about three-wire Edison distribution system. And it goes on to say Edison discovered that if the positive wire of one generator and negative wire of another generator having an equal output voltage were combined, one wire of the four from the two generators could be eliminated between stations. This system resulted in the saving of copper losses. On balancing load between the outside wires and the common wire, no current flows in the common wire, but he called it his neutral wire. Haha, that's when neutral came along. As shown, if the load is unbalanced, the neutral will carry the amount of unbalanced current. It goes on the whole thing. This book was published 1912 by the Edison Electric Institute. Edison, and it tells you all about how they distributed DC all over Manhattan, Dick, over.
Boy, you've got quite an antique there, Mel. The Edison Electric Institute, according to the title page of that book, probably gives an address. Was the address Manhattan?
1111 19th Street. 19th Street. New York City. How do you like that? How do you like that? Zip code was at that time 36. Yep. It was published at sea. First publishing was 1912. And was for electrical metermen's work. Inside it tells you the Edison Electric Institute says for electrical metermen handbook for work, and tells you a whole bunch of different people that should be using this as their reference. Over.
Now I think in the old days we didn't have a five-digit zip code. but you did have in a number of places a zip code within a particular city. You might have New York 27, New York, for instance, as a zip code within a particular city. You might have Brooklyn 47 or Manhattan Beach 41, New York, something like that. Was there a two-digit zip code in that address, Mel? Go ahead.
36, New York 36. Okay. Now I'm just looking here. Some very interesting things. I haven't opened this book in years. I don't even know where I got it from. I think I saw it in one of the junk shops in New York years ago. I used to go through a lot of them. When I had a little break, I used to always go into the old bookshop, old bookstores, and I bought quite a number of old books that, you know, pertain to electrical or mechanical. Yes, I have one on mechanical engineering, you know. I know I have several books and all, and it tells you about Edison provided electric power for New York City and then went on to provide power for Pennsylvania Electric Company. Also, the United Illuminating Company and Jersey Central Power. And then he also Southern California Edison Company. So, they tell a whole bunch of things about all his things. And then he goes on to tell you that he had about people that worked for him and that became electrical engineers. And they said that you must understand Ohm's Law. A whole thing here on understanding Ohm's Law, which is mandatory, Kirchhoff's Law, and what else did he have here? Oh, I don't know, how to set up a utility in a community, Dick, over.
Good stuff. And do you remember the IRE shows that used to be held in the Coliseum in New York City? IRE stood for the Institute of Radio Engineers. Which eventually gathered, joined forces with the, I forgot who, but it became the IEEE, Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers. So there were electrical engineers and radio engineers who joined forces. But it used to be called the IRE show, I think up until around 1966 or so. I bet you've attended a few of those, Mel. I bet you and I have run into each other in the dark ages of of the 50s and the 60s, and we just didn't know each other yet. Back to you, Mel. KQLIW.
I can tell you a couple. One time I know I shook hands with you, but it was so quick. This was a lot of crowds, but that was at another function. They tell you here, for instance, one of the people here on the editorial staff, they have there's a few of them. They all have after their names that they're EEI, Dick. EEI. I don't know what that stood for, over.
Could it be Electrical Engineering Institute member or something like that? The first time you and I met, where you shook my hand, make a guess as to what year and what was the event, Mel. Go ahead.
Someplace, we were out in the field, you had your stress parabolic with your call letters on it. I saw it. I stood behind it. I watched you demonstrate. People were asking you questions. It was a lot of years ago. I don't remember even where it was. And I walked over and I was saying a few words to you, and other people were asking. So I just shook hands with you, and off I went, over.
Could that have been the Saddlebrook Park in New Jersey, where the East Coast VHF Society was holding an antenna game competition? Saddlebrook Park, New Jersey. Is that possible, Mel? Go ahead.
Yes, it's as good as mine. The only thing I can picture, I remember your parabolic antenna with your call letters on it, over.
Yep. In the old days, I used to set it up with the reflecting screening in front of those bent bars and put a zillion pieces of little wire to hold it down. I eventually caught on to put the screening behind the bars, and it saved an awful lot of time. And I put that thing together on two or three occasions, way back in roughly 1968. Yeah, that was roughly 1968-69. Saddlebrook Park, New Jersey, where Paul Wade, WA2ZZF in those days, ran this antenna gain competition as a member of the East Coast VHF Society, along with Alan Katz, KTUYH, and quite often they were aided by Dr. Dick Turin, W2IMU of Bell Laboratories, who gave them a hint as to the right way to set up an outdoor antenna range so that you could make good measurements on a reflective ground plane antenna range. Some of the good old days. And if someone had told you then the relationship you and I would have later on, wow. And Mel and I have got some crazy things together. We were born the same year, almost the same month. We both have a daughter named Julie. We both got ham radio licenses at roughly the same time. You can tell by the call letters being somewhat similar. He was a little more progressive than I am. He got his license earlier than me. And he was born almost a month earlier than I am. Other than that, we've got a lot in common. Alrighty, Joe had a further question. W-A-2-R-Y-Y. Go right ahead, Joe. K-2-L-I-W.
I wanted to give you one final quote here. It really give you a laugh.
Go right ahead.
Although alternating current does have some applications, direct current is necessary for all industrial purposes as of now. And alternating current may, in the future, be used in some minor work. Vic, over.
Are those Edison's words? Is he the author of that statement, Mel? Go ahead.
This is his book. This is the Edison Institute. What do you think they were going to say? That's it. That's it. May have some minor work. The way things are phrased in here, it looks like, how should I say it, like a type of English that was maybe popular over 100 years ago, over.
The language is, according to my wife who teaches English, a continuously evolving language. Elizabethan language is extremely foreign to us today. And what's really amazing to me is that the people who would conduct a play in the 1600s decided to use a different kind of expressions, a different kind of vocabulary. People on stage in the 1600s almost spoke a different language. It wasn't the normal common language you would have day to day. Hey, we have to flip over to this other more poetic language because we're on play, on stage. My wife has speculated that they went to the more poetic language because it's easier to memorize your lines that way. And modern-day movies, we speak the same language we would ordinarily when talking to each other face-to-face. And does that mean we have more trouble memorizing our lines these days? Maybe so. But language is continuous. Vocabulary and language is continuously evolving. The dictionaries have to add a whole lot of brand-new technical words every time they make a new edition of the dictionary. There's a lot of words that never existed before on each one of those editions. Over to you, Joe, W-H-Y-Y, K-2-L-I-W.
Okay. W-H-Y-Y here. Back to the subject I asked about the water contamination of the cable. Do you believe water would increase in its absorption rate as far as the RF is concerned with the power level? If you put, like, say, an extremely low level RF in this, so talking about almost like a receive signal, for example, something extremely low, like, you know, 10, 20, 30 microwatts of power compared to something where you're putting absolutely like real positive power. Does the absorption actually change as you go to a higher power level? Because you said the water molecules are trying to resist the RF energy. Would that function actually change the power level density? You know, the density of the power.
Absolutely. The answer is yes. But now your next question is going to be how much. I know that water with mineral matter in it has a certain conductivity, which is temperature sensitive, just making the water hotter or colder, frozen or liquid, gaseous or vapor phase or whatever, all affects resistivity. One of the things I discovered as I was using this bowl full of water, this glass bowl, as a dummy load for my 2,000 volt power supply, that as I heated up the water and it started boiling, its characteristics changed. It would make different colors when I would extract one of the probes from the water and create a flash. It's a current that it would draw would change as a function of temperature. The next thing you're about to say is that since the molecule doesn't quite keep up, it's got a hysteresis loss, when the local E field gets stronger, does that mean that water molecule flipping back and forth in polarity does a better job and therefore its loss tangent increases or decreases? I do know that on a couple of occasions, I knew I had water in a connector at the top of the tower. And I had a 1,000-watt transmitter. I said, gee, there's a simple solution. I'll run a key down for 10 minutes and boil away the water. Good, simple-sounding solution. Dead wrong. Didn't work. I think what I did is I managed to turn the water into steam. The steam rammed itself down the foam-filled cable and just deposited itself somewhere else. Also, in the vicinity of the connector, you ended up with this white, pasty junk, which was what the boiled water turned into with the dissimilar metals that were in existence in the vicinity of that connector. The connector, you know, has got the nickel plating and silver plating and whatever, and you're breaking down all of those substances with the high voltage, high current power that I was trying to put through it. I thought I would dry out the connector by putting high power RF through it. No way. Doesn't work. Made it worse. And I also would notice that if you had a great big long dry spell where some of the water in the cable would dry out, that the antenna would behave differently when it started raining the next time. You would see the changes in characteristics as the white pasty stuff in the connector, as sort of a powder, started becoming moisturized. It went back into the conducting mode. So you would have a short period of time of a good performing antenna, even though there used to be water in it, and you hadn't yet gotten up there and cleaned it all out. And when I finally brought that antenna down, let me drop. When Hurricane Gloria brought it down for me, and I went and measured the insertion loss of each of those FM8 cables, the foam-filled ITT cables, which I thought was the cat's meow in flexible 50-ohm cables in those days. And I went and measured the insertion loss. Every one of those cables had either doubled or tripled in insertion loss in dB per foot. So they were all sucking up water, not just the ones where the connectors leaked. The water vapor was migrating through the outer thick polyethylene jacket that was on that cable and getting into that foam. So it was quite a mess. So keeping water out of connectors and foam-filled flexible cables, you've got to be very careful with them, in my opinion. Guarantee, when you go to the book called Von Hippel, a guy named Von Hippel wrote a great big large format book. It must have been the 12 by 17 format size, probably 1,000 pages. And what Mr. Von Hippel did was to list every single substance you can think of, water with all kinds of mineral contents, and every single chemical you can think of at every possible temperature. He measured conductivity, loss tangent versus frequency, dielectric characteristics, permittivity. He measures the permittivity, the specific vector of permittivity of every one of those cables at all reasonable frequencies. A heroic effort. And I was very unhappy about the fact that the technical library at AIL had a copy of Von Hippel, which I referred to many times. All of a sudden, they got a hold of some crazy person in the building one day who said, we're going to squeeze down the library to a smaller size so that we can put a couple of more offices around that area. And they threw out a number of very good technical books. And I hadn't been given enough forewarning to know to go to the dumpster on that particular day and collect these books that they were throwing out. Von Hippel was one of the books they threw out. I was powerful and happy about that. So, I know the answer is yes, I don't know how much. And I'll bet you there's a website that might tell you. And once you know the name Von Hippel, I think it's only a matter of time before some smart company like Google takes the Von Hippel book and puts all of that valuable data onto a website. So V2RYY with the right delay, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, what I was getting at with all this, there's always you know, something I'm getting at with these things. Eventually you find out what it is. I'm having a problem with an antenna on a particular building where my repeater is located, and you know, I don't know if I got water in the cable or not. I've taken it apart. I don't seem to measure any resistance across it. I've done a return loss check with the transmission line loaded, and it looks like it's okay. It seems to indicate know, a relatively good return loads with a proper load at the end of the cable. But knowing how much power my transmitter is putting out compared to another station on the same location who's putting out more power than me, I get a significant difference in power load between his station and mine, and we're both using the same kind of antennas. So this is why I'm asking all these kind of questions. This is what this is basically leading up to.
Yeah, measuring the S11, the return loss of a cable when it's got a good termination on the far end, is a necessary but not sufficient. If you allow me to distribute the water evenly enough throughout the foam of a foam-filled cable, I can find for you a cable that will have a significant insertion loss from end to end, yet the return loss with good termination will look like everything's hunky-dory. If the water is grouped in one particular spot, like gathering at the end connector, you're going to get a great big reflection coefficient. But if it's evenly distributed, so the cable just increases in its loss, a return loss measurement may not show it to you. You should also follow that up by either a real insertion loss, put a known amount of power in one end of the cable and find out what comes out of the other end, or put a known mismatch at the far end, a short or an open, and now measure the return loss of the cable. And if your cable has 1 dB of loss under good conditions, and you put a short circuit at the far end, you should measure a return loss of roughly 2 dB. 1 dB going up, it bounces off the short circuit or open circuit, and 1 dB of loss coming back down, and you measure 2 dB of return loss. So a mismatched return loss or a true insertion loss probably is required to really know what that cable is doing, Joe. W2RYY, K2RYW.
That's why I was asking the question about the different power levels, if they would cause a different insertion loss across the cable. Now, if you do that kind of test using a piece of test equipment that's going to put out a very low level of RF energy, and you can look at that amount of energy coming back with a like a directional coupler and look at the thing and say, oh, okay, this is what a load on the end of the cable, this is what a short, this is what an open, this is what I see at the measurement at the other end. Now, if I get certain readings there, it might indicate that the cable doesn't really look like it has high insertion loss, but yet, say, if I put power into it, it might be another story. So it seems like, it's, from what you're saying, I'm going to have to actually put a known RF power level into the cable at one end and actually measure what comes out of the other end to actually prove that if that's the culprit, my problem. Correct?
You're correct, but for another reason. If I had a tiny bit of water in the cable, so that instead of having 1 dB of loss, it has 1.1 dB of loss, and you do that at a low power level, you'll measure 2.2 dB of return loss. If you now make the measurement at a kilowatt level, I think you're going to measure 2.2 dB of return loss again, if that's what it's caused by. However, if in the process of putting that connector together, one of those whiskers of the braid got displaced in the wrong place, so the whisker is almost creating a short circuit between outer conductor and center conductor, and I make the measurement at a low power level, everything's hunky-dory. At a high power level, that whisker that's almost touching the center conductor is now creating a corona discharge, and now I can get a hell of a lot more loss and or noise in the repeater at the higher power level. It's a very unlikely condition, but not impossible. That, I think, is the major mechanism, other than that and something boiling inside the antenna, so to speak. That's the only other mechanism by which your antenna system can make a drastic change as a function of power level. Now back to you, Joe, KQRIW.
Okay, well, I'm using LDF-4-DFP as a transmission line, so I don't know really how easily the water would get in there, actually through the jacket itself. I don't see any places in the jacket that that's marked up at all where it looks like water or something could have got through it or between the jacket and the outer copper conductor. But it's a little bit of a mystery to me. So I guess I'll have to do some more some more tests with this thing to actually prove out what the problem is. And yes, I have had problems with my particular repeater with noise in the system occasionally. That seems to come and go, and actually it gets to the point where sometimes where even 25 or 45 watts power of my house, I can't make the repeater. It's noisy as hell. And then it sometimes seems like it was almost instantly clear up. So I'm not sure what the problem is. But I did do a test by putting a signal into the antenna, a low-level signal from that from each antenna, using the same length of cable between the generator and the and each particular antenna, and they have similar line length. Like one, my line length is about a little less than 50 foot. The other one's about maybe 65 to 70 foot, same kind of cable. And at a receiving point, being received with a similar type of antenna at a very high altitude, like say about 100 feet or so, both antennas seem to show the same signal level at a distance of say 3.5 or 4 miles away.
Okay, so your two antennas appear to be fairly similar in performance. The other antenna of someone else's repeater that seems to be higher in performance than yours, is it on the exact same location in the tower? Of course the answer is no. It may be on a different face of the tower at a different altitude. And depending on the way multipath works, that slight difference in altitude can make a huge difference. You've seen the effect when you have your handy-talkie in your hand and you're listening to a particular weak repeater, and a very small amount of translation of that handy-talkie vertically, horizontally, front and back, can make a huge, and polarization rotation of the handy-talkie, can make a huge difference in signal strength. Back to you, Joe. KQRIW.
Okay, both antennas are mounted on the building. They're not mounted on towers. Well, one is mounted on tower section, but for all practical purposes, mounted the same way mine is mounted. It's pole mounted alongside the building type of thing. So they're both up in the clear. There's really nothing around them to affect the pattern too terribly much. You know, it's like typical commercial buildings. You know, you're going to have a lot of antennas around you within about like 10, 15 feet between you and the other antenna, that type of thing. And the receiving antenna at the other end is about, like I said, at least 100, about 100 feet off the ground and about 3.5 to 4 miles away. Now, with a signal generator going into each antenna using the same level for the generator, about plus 20 dBm, the amateur at the other end of the setup was noting that he got almost the same readings between the both antennas. Yet, if I put power into my antenna, for my particular repeater, even accounting for the different power level the other station is using on his repeater, which is about four times what I'm using, there's still a discrepancy of a couple of dB more. I get about 8, maybe 9 dB difference between my repeater output and the other guy's repeater output. So this is why I'm asking all these kind of questions. So I know, going forward, I'll know which way to how to attack the problem and probably come up with a reasonable idea of what's going on.
The guy who is measuring the signal strength for you, was he using an S meter on his receiver? Back to you, Joe.
No, he was using a IFR 1500 service monitor with the spectrum analyzer.
Good answer. Okay, that's an amplitude calibration. That machine, in theory, is traceable to the Bureau of Standards. And by way of putting in step attenuators, you can also do some confirming. But now, the other repeater that runs higher in power, but still there's a discrepancy, is it on a slightly different frequency? Even though it's on the exact same roof, but it's not the exact same altitude. They're both on the same roof, but one's on a tower. And are they on a slightly different frequency, Joe? Go ahead.
Yes, they are on different operating frequencies, about a mega and a half of far approximately. But the altitude of both antennas above the roof of the building itself, the roof line of the building, as far as the radials of each antenna on a superstation master, they basically would be considered identical. The only reason he's using a tower section is because that's how he had to mount his particular installation on a particular corner of the building. He had to put a tower section to be able to do that. I'm using pipe amounts from the wall type of thing, but they're basically the same kind of altitude.
In the direction of the receiving site, does one antenna have more roof in front of it than the other? You said the magic words, he's near the corner of the building. So the terrain in front of his antenna, since he's near the corner of the building, he's seeing more air. Your antenna is seeing more roof out in the near field of the antenna. So you've got a slight difference in frequency, a significant difference in location on the roof. And it's probably 30 feet of difference between the two antennas. Is that true, Joe? Go ahead.
Probably more like about maybe 15 to 18 feet actually across between the both antennas across the top part of the building. It's like, you know, I guess what do you call the top of the stairwell that comes out of the building, that type of thing, but not the not where the elevators are, they don't go up that high, but something like that. Yeah. In the direction measuring of the measuring station, he is looking at in the direction from the that end particular antenna of his installation. There is basically nothing in the way. He's on the corner of the building, or there's no roof in the way. I have some roof in my way, but not very much. But if you look optically from my antenna to the receiving station, I can basically see it with a pair of binoculars.
In the direction where the receiving site was located from your antenna, how many feet of roof are in front of your antenna before it goes out to free air?
That's a good question. Probably in his direction, maybe 20 feet, because you're talking about, he's not directly east of the building, he's actually north, northeast slightly. So I'd say maybe on an angular 20 feet, 25 feet of building, or actual roof area, because I'm on the south side of a particular installation. But, see, the thing is, what I'm getting at is, would a signal generator put into my antenna and put into the other guy's antenna, it produces the same signal level at his receiving antenna between both antennas. And we tested these across the entire amateur band going 2 megs apart. And the only difference seems to be, on the high end of the band, my antenna seems to drop out a little more than his antenna does. But not by very much, though.
At the high end of the band, yours drops a little bit more, is what I think you said. How accurately do you believe you know his power output of his transmitter? Go ahead.
Well, as far as what the bird wattmeter says, it's pretty accurate. I think he's running, he's running an amplifier, not a bigger amplifier than I have, on completely different type of station. His power output is fairly accurate, and it is, like I said, about 4 times what I'm running.
Okay, you're both measuring on a good bird wattmeter. That's traceable to the Bureau. That's a bit of a mystery. The fact that yours drops off a little faster on the high end is a little bit curious. Also, when you do these measurements day to day, you're going to find differences. And for all we know, the day you did the measurements by putting in weak signals and the day you did the comparison by real transmitters might not have been the same hour of the same day. Is that true, Joe? Go ahead.
Okay, well, I didn't... He actually measured the difference between my repeater output and his, and he saw a very similar reading off his antenna that's 100 feet above the ground compared to my monitor antenna, which is what I'm using for receiving antenna. He saw a similar difference in decibels between one to the other. In two different locations, he showed a very similar, difference between signal A, signal B, coming out of two different antennas. And my power is, it is very close to that 60 dB, less than his power, because it is 4 times less, and I know that, and I took that into account already, but there seems to be more differential than just 60 dB of power. It's like about 8 to 9 dB difference between the two stations. So it just made me wonder if my, situation, I've got some sort of, additional insertion loss someplace, like possibly the RF transmission line or something like that, not accounting for. It seems to sweep good with a Sidemaster. This is what it sweeps the entire antenna circuit. This is why the whole thing is a little puzzling to me.
Is there any possibility that your transmitter power output fades after some time?
It doesn't. Well, if the power doesn't come up, this particular transmitter I'm using doesn't come up to the full power, it takes a very short amount of time, maybe 30 seconds or something like that. But I've ran it for a length of time where the thing is totally on, it's totally heated up, so it's stable. It does do that. It does come up to a low power by about maybe 10 or 15 watts. And then it gets up to the higher power. It's the kind of transfer I'm using, and there's nothing I can do about that. I can't control that part of the physics.
Okay, the pleasant news is that your transmitter fades upward in power output. But 15 watts is not anywhere near the number of dBs you're talking about. And yes, you've got a mystery. But there's two different propagating paths that you think are similar, and the RF doesn't see it that way. 15 or so feet of difference between the antennas in cross-range location can make a significant difference in the way the multipath occurs. And now the hard part to explain is how come the multipath difference wasn't there at low power level, but it is at the high power level. And yes, you've got a mystery. That's a tough one. I got no glamour fix on that one, Joe. Let's see if Paul is still with us. He probably is going to sleep by now because he's got to go to work in the morning. WS2N, are you still there, Paul? K2LIW? Okay, I think Paul has left. I think we've answered everyone's question. And have you got any good email we should go to, Mel? K2KEY, K2LIW.
2L.
Stand by, Mel. Go ahead, Bernie.
I have a question. I missed check-in, but I have a question if you wish to entertain it.
Okay, you're a little bit noisy, but go ahead.
Okay, I apologize. My bigger wattage unit, I forgot to charge the battery this evening, so I'm on low power. I heard something over the repeater the other day which got me thinking. The gentleman was transmitting on 2 meters using a D5RV, his HF antenna, and he was getting out. He was able to tune it to a reasonable SWR, and he was able to get out. He made a comment that it was his understanding that if you were using an antenna that was multiple wavelengths and length, that it was not as efficient as, say, a half-wave dipole or a quarter-wave. If you exceed, say, a half-wave and a dipole and make it a two-wave or a four-wave or a six-wave dipole, is that more lossy or do you put out less signal than if you have a strict half-wave dipole?
More loss, unlikely, unless he's used pretty resistive wire. As you go beyond half-wavelength of the antenna, you start getting a more and more complicated antenna pattern. And you can see those antenna patterns in the ARRL antenna book. And in the particular direction you want to transmit a signal to somebody, the chances are higher that one of those nulls in the pattern is going to be aimed toward him if the antenna is multiple wavelengths long. The pattern, by definition, must become more and more bumpy as you make the antenna longer and longer. So, that's the difference in gain and pattern and directivity as opposed to efficiency. If you take the pure definition of efficiency, there is no way an antenna can be inefficient other than burning up the power in the form of heat. Well, if the antenna is high enough above the ground that you're not heating up the ground, and if the antenna is made out of reasonable conductivity wire, and if you're putting 100 watts into that wire antenna, I'm having great difficulty believing the antenna can dissipate more than 10 watts of it without some portion of the wire getting hot and you recognize the discoloration. So you pour 100 watts into an antenna key down for a few minutes, and if any portion of it is inefficient, the only mechanism inefficiency is something's got to get hot. Of all the power you put into an antenna, there's only three things it can do with it. Radiate some of it into space, that's good. Reflect some of it back to the transmitter, you can measure that as VSWR, or burn some of it up as heat. And by the heat, you can tell right away what got hot. There's nothing else it can do with it, with the exception of an antenna mounted so close to the ground that you're now heating the ground. The ground is absorbing the RF energy that was radiated by the antenna, absorbing it and turning it into heat in the ground. But at any reasonable altitude, that's not taking place. So he may call it inefficiency. I think it's more accurately to call it a more complicated antenna pattern that doesn't happen to favor the direction of the guy I want to talk to. That's what I think is going on, Bernie. K2IO, K2LIW.
Okay, good enough. It didn't make sense to me that it could be radiated and he left. I did not think about the pattern stuff, but I think he had probably confused the pattern issue with radiation efficiency. Thank you much, K2IO.
Okay, Bernie, good question. Mel, how's your mailbag? K2LAW? And, oh, wait a minute now. I forgot to set my watch back. I thought it was 11:45. It's 10:45. You got some time. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, found a section in this book on Edison. Very interesting. Requirements to become a meter man. They don't call a meter man. They call a metering employee, Dick. You know what the requirements are? Over.
Being able to read English, being able to take a watt-hour meter and know how to interpret the dials. I don't think he's got going to get into Kirchhoff's laws and Thevenin and Norton equivalents, but he's got to have a certain height so he can reach, his eyes can reach up to where the meter is in some industrial location. So, tell me some of these crazy requirements, Mel. Go ahead.
Right out of the Edison book. Okay, to become a metering employee, you should be of good Christian Caucasian background and have attended public school to the 8th grade. That's to begin with, Dick. Over.
Wow. That is not politically correct today by a long shot. And for that matter, many of the movies made by Hollywood were far from politically correct by modern-day standards. Shirley Temple treated certain people in certain ways that today we wouldn't tolerate. Back to you, Mel.
You must also serve as a wiring inspector and under specific instructions from your supervisor be able to discuss wiring deficiencies. And a basic knowledge of principles of service wiring is good assistance in discovering hazardous conditions. Over.
I'll bet you in 1911, Mel, a number of buildings had cloth-covered wire where the cloth covering had been scuffed by industrial process that was going on in that vicinity. And I'll bet you quite a few of those wires were bare. I know that the switches, the on-off switches for lighting that they used to use in those days, had a lot of open frame wiring. In fact, the person in the White House who was assigned the task of turning the switches that turned on the lights and turned the lights on and off at the appropriate time at the White House, that person was given hazardous duty pay. Over to you, Mel.
Some of the things they have in here, I don't even want to bring up. It's unbelievable. Oh, God. And remember, you also should have attended public school at least through the 8th grade, Dick. Over.
So a guy who is a ham radio operator and knows a lot about electronics has built his own power supplies and whatever, but for some crazy reason had quit school in the 7th grade, could not be, in theory, allowed to do that occupation. I guess they thought they had to set some kind of standards, and there's always exceptions to the rule. There's a particular person that I have worked with in the past who is an extremely good microwave antenna engineer who did not graduate from high school. Back to you, Mel.
Roger, I'm going to go on to tell you six things here about even about how to subject must also be familiar, I don't know what this means, with truck traffic and public streets and especially alleys and roads. Oh boy, oh boy. Imagine that this was become a metering employee in 1912, Dick. Over.
Now, is this another book? Because the first book you were reading was published in 1911, is what I think you said, Mel. Go ahead.
The book, 1912. Let me get back to the beginning. When was it published? I think it's sort of first edition. First edition. Published, 1912. And they sold 5,000 copies. They didn't tell you how many copies. 1912, number of copies printed, 5,000, over.
The Titanic sunk what year? Was it around 1911, Mel?
1912, the year the Titanic sank. They sold this book, believe it or not, same year, over.
A busy year for electronics. And of the 1,000 people that I think they saved 1,000 out of 3,000 on the Titanic, and almost all of those savings was because of that radio transmission, which eventually was received, and it brought help. Without that radio transmission, I think the majority of those survivors would not have survived. How back to you, Mel.
Okay. somebody else wants. Well, I'm going to say one thing. To be involved with the Edison Company in 1912, I think your last name should have been something like John Wasp. Over.
Yeah. Neil, let's see now. Neil Armstrong. I wonder if he would be allowed to be hired by that company.
Well, in fact, you know something? He actually alludes to the fact here. Oh, I was reading here about Kirchhoff that, like, sort of like these people, something to the effect, I've lost the page, that their some of their information should be taken with sort of, you know, not as the gospel, because they are not, in other words, you're alluding to the fact that he didn't consider them, that they weren't Americans, they weren't maybe of the right background, that their theories and their principles should not be taken completely, you know, as gospel, Dick, over.
I'll bet you there's a lot of books in those days written that way, Mel. The things that we take for granted today, with reference to persecution and ethnic issues and so on, we've come a long way. This country has treated certain people rather poorly in the past for reasons that now sound crazy. Our movies, our books, they've all gone through a lot of evolution. We still got a ways to go, though. And have you gotten any good mail this week, Mel? Go ahead.
Yeah, truth, I never even got a chance to look. I was one of the hundreds of amateur radio operators that attended today the New York City Marathon and volunteered to help with emergency communications along the 26 point, whatever, 2 mile. So I was up very early, to say the least. I was up at like 5 o'clock in the morning, and I left the house here about a little after 6 to get to our patrol site on 4th Avenue, and then I rode my bicycle there, so it was a bit of a miserable weather this morning, Dick, over.
Yeah, I think it was kind of drizzly in the morning, 55 or so degrees, and I guess the marathon people like those kind of temperatures, I believe. You're on 4th Avenue. I think you were near mile marker number 4 in the past. I think maybe you occupy the same spot. Give us a little bit of a rundown of what the New York City Marathon was like. I think the females are given a start, what, about a half hour or so earlier than the males? Some significant length of time. And I'm sure they came whizzing by in front of you long before the males did. So what was it like? Did the weather get better? What all did you see? And I'll bet you saw people in all kinds of costumes who are presenting certain causes. I remember when I was a mile marker, and I think I was around mile marker 20 or so, way back in the dark past for a 5-year period of time. There were people who would run the whole length of the marathon backwards with certain costumes on, carrying a tray full of food or drinks or whatever. Tell us some of the things you saw, and did the weather finally clear up, Mel? KQKEY. Wait for the beep. KQLIW.
This is K2KEY. Well, begin with, first people they had were the Achilles, what they call the Achilles. These are people with, oh my God, some unusual people, I'd say. I saw people that you have to say, boy, human spirit sometimes is unbelievable what they'll try under the worst circumstances. And then, of course, came the ladies. I saw them all run by. And then eventually, you know, the men, I think, I don't remember
net
how much
tonight
separation
at
time it was.
Net tonight
but
at
the men, portion of the race, which, of course, then is the mix. And then finally is the phase of all the mixed people of, you know, that, in other words, these are the elite runners get the first shot. The elite women runners, the elite men runners, and then everybody else, and boy, that was a mob scene.
Ah,
my God, I was at mile four. So people still were, you know, able to move along. I'm sure some dropped out later on, but boy.